Okay, I see it's 9 o'clock. There are people who are not here yet, but we start at 9 o'clock. I don't see Rabbi Kelman yet, but I assume he'll be arriving shortly. Today we're going to be concluding, I hope, with Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer and beginning with Rabbi Reines, although it's probably going to be the case that Kalischer might take us the whole class, and then we'll start Reines the next class. I'm already beginning to see that we probably won't get to Rav Chaim Hirschenson this time because he really needs two full classes. Just a few things because of what people contacted me and other things. For those who haven't heard, it's relevant to what we've been doing. Rabbi Emanuel Rachman passed away earlier today. The funeral is tomorrow. Unfortunately, I'll be in Scranton. Otherwise, I would have attended. It really is the end of an era. We've spoken about him in previous classes. But he defined orthodoxy, a certain type of orthodoxy, for a long time. You can see a bit how orthodoxy's changed in that in the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, he was part of the mainstream unorthodox rabbinate, the president of the RCA, always a bit on the liberal side, but certainly part of the rabbinate. Then, of course, orthodoxy started moving to the right. Now, we have examples of where orthodoxy moves to the right and the people stay in the same place, and then they become regarded as leftists. I think Mark Angel is a good example. He was president of the RCA about 15 years ago, and he hasn't changed, and yet orthodoxy just in the last 15 years has moved so far to the right that he no longer feels welcome in the RCA. He formed his own group, but it's not only that he no longer feels welcome, they no longer want him in the RCA and regard his ideas as pasul. But he's always stayed where he is, and now he's regarded as a left-winger. With Rachman, he always had liberal tendencies, but he kept them in check, and he actually was a very big Talmud Chacham. I'm not going to say he's one of the, you know, Gedolei Yisrael, but he was a Lamdan. One of the most important rabbis in the New York area, very involved in YU. It'll be interesting to see what YU does with regard to his memory, being that he had such a long association with them. But when orthodoxy began to go to the right in the 70s, Rachman didn't stay still. He then moved to the left. And at another time, perhaps, we can speak about some of his innovations. And when he saw that orthodoxy wasn't going to change the way he wanted, he moved to the left himself. So again, Baruch Dayan HaEmes for Rabbi Rachman, who was 98 years old. Perhaps, there might be some older ones, I don't know of any, perhaps the oldest living musmach of Yeshivas Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan. Again, there might be one or two older than him, but I'm unaware of any of them. A couple other things before we begin. Incidentally, he's not a graduate of Yeshiva University. He went to Columbia, and he's also a lawyer. I knew him a bit. We spoke a number of times. Again, at a future time, I can speak about our conversations. He wanted me to write his biography, and it's a whole story. A couple other things which you'll find interesting. I'm holding in my hand a page of Volume 6 of the Be'er Moshe of Rav Moshe Stern. I just mentioned this is page 140. For those of you who find this sort of thing interesting, especially if you know Moshe Stern, his famous attack on Rav Soloveitchik, in this tshuva, he quotes Rabbi Weinberg, and I just think it's interesting. He's trying to show that even Rabbi Weinberg agrees with him. He calls him a famous rabbi. Shegam ha-mitchadshim, that also the mitchadshim are in awe of what his psakim. Mitchadshim, you have to know this use of the hitpael is a very negative term. You say the mitchadshim, the self-styled modernizers. I guess maybe he referred to us as mitchadshim. You see this in medieval, by the people who criticize the philosophers, they call them mitpalsifim, which can be translated as self-styled philosophers, although Ibn Tibbon uses the term as synonymous with philosopher, but that's not how it's used in later terms. A couple other things. I mentioned towards the end of class that if you wanted to see the halachos of Thanksgiving, you can see Rabbi Broid's article. So someone who's listening now read the article and emailed me. He wanted me to elaborate briefly because I mentioned in the article. So now is actually, I'll take 1 minute. We should get it on the record. because it's the way it's recorded by Broyd is incorrect. So for historical purposes, let me put it on the record. Rabbi Broyd writes in his article after quoting Rav Schechter, and this is famous, of course, well known that Rav Soloveitchik had a very positive attitude towards Thanksgiving. He writes, quote, "Others have also recounted that Rabbi Soloveitchik ruled this way and that he found it difficult to comprehend how one could consider Thanksgiving a Gentile holiday or that it was prohibited to celebrate it." And in the footnote, he says, Rabbi Howard Jachter of Brooklyn notes that he explicitly spoke to Rabbi Soloveitchik about this in July 1985, and that Rabbi Soloveitchik affirmed this ruling and did not see any problem with celebrating Thanksgiving. Dr. Avi Feldblum of Highland Park, New Jersey, also confirmed to this author that he heard such a ruling from Rabbi Soloveitchik, as did Dr. Mark Shapiro of Boston. Okay, let me just put it on the record here. I actually wrote out the entire story for Broyd, but he didn't get it right here. I really should have been the one at the beginning of this footnote, and let me explain why. In 1985, July, that's correct, I was in the Rav's Kollel. It was the last time the Rav taught in his Kollel, his summer Kollel, and then he went back to YU, and he only taught for the fall semester, and that was it. He never taught again. Howard Jachter, now known as Chaim Jachter, not in Brooklyn anymore, but in Elizabeth, he's on the Basin. I think parallel to us, he's giving a course on Halakha. He had a car, so he would drive the Rav back and forth. He needed a second person because the Rav needed two people to hold him when they walked. So I took advantage of this, and the Rav gave the shiur twice a week, if I remember correctly. So I would go there and bring the Rav back and forth from the Torsky house. And it was only 5 minutes, but in those 5 minutes, you had time to ask questions. So one time, I asked the Rav, I didn't know about, Rav Schechter's book hadn't appeared, I didn't know any of the famous stories, but I had heard that the Rav was, celebrated Thanksgiving. So I took the opportunity to ask him, did he think there was any problem with it? And he asked me, what could be the problem? And I replied, I had heard, that since it was originally a Christian holiday, which it really wasn't, but at least it began by Christians and they celebrated it in a religious way, that maybe it should be forbidden. And Rabbi Soloveitchik said as follows to me. He asked me point blank, and again, I don't recall Rabbi Jachter conversing with him at all, except at the end, Rabbi Jachter asked him another question. But it was my conversation, and Rabbi Soloveitchik asked me the following question. Are you going to church on Thanksgiving? And I replied, no. And he said, then what could be the problem? And I think that question shows something very interesting. A number of people, Rabbi Rakef and others, have spoken about how Rabbi Soloveitchik found incomprehensible the change that was going on in Orthodoxy that begins in the 70s, and he couldn't really grasp much of what was happening, including from his own students. If he was alive today, he'd see all sorts of other stuff which he couldn't grasp and understand. We'll talk a bit. I'll give you another example. But the way he phrased the question, it was just incomprehensible to him that anyone would have, and I don't even think these are halachic issues. I think it's an issue of separatism, of wanting to be different from the Gentiles. But that is the story. So there, I put it on the record. And finally, one correction of what I said a couple weeks ago. Ellie Neuberger, I don't know Ellie Neuberger, but he listens, he downloads the classes and listens to them. He corrected something I said, so let me share it with you. I had been speaking right at the beginning with the Nazir, how I mentioned that the Nazir's grandfather was the Rav in Radin, and I mentioned how the Chavetz Chaim was not the Rav, and that there was a yeshiva in Radin, but the Chavetz Chaim wasn't involved with it. What I thought is as follows. I've never really investigated the Radin Yeshiva, like I have Sobotka and Mir and the rest. My impression was that the Chavetz Chaim, he certainly started a group of Bachrim early on, came to study with him, and that did turn into the Yeshiva. What I thought was that as the Yeshiva became bigger, and it's true, the Chavetz Chaim's son-in-law was involved, but then it became an independent institution, and the Chavetz Chaim really had nothing to do with it. He sent out fundraising letters, but I thought he had no involvement in the administration when people like Rav Naftali Trupp were appointed during the years of the 1910s and the 1920s. But Ellie Neuberger points out that that's not true. He calls my attention to the biography of the Chafetz Chaim by Rabbi Yosher, And I also found an article, a book that was published by Shmuel Kalman Mirsky called Mosto Torah Be'Europa after World War II. He published a volume, he edited a volume with articles on all the great yeshivas. Rodin wasn't a great yeshiva like the others, like Slobodka or Amir, but there's an article in it. And I was wrong, and Ellie's correct. Thank you, Ellie, for that clarification. The Chavetz Chaim was involved with the yeshiva until the end, and involved in who should be appointed the Rosh Yeshiva and things of that matter. So thank you for that clarification. I can send the link to anyone who's interested. Two more things. Rabbi Kalman pointed out that Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook said that you don't need to do Kriya when you see the Makom of the Beis Hamikdash today, the Har HaBayit. I was unaware of that, or I must have seen it sometime, but I forgot about it. I found actually a number of sources that speak about it, including Rav Avinair, who explains the position, because Rav Shapiro disagreed with Rav Tzvi Yehuda. Rav Shapiro said that Jerusalem you don't do Kriya on because it's under Jewish control. But Har HaBayit, it's destroyed, so you should do Kriya. But Rav Tzvi Yehuda explained, and I think this is quite interesting, that the reason Har HaBayit's destroyed is not because we can't rebuild it. In theory, we can rebuild it. We have control over it. It's just that there are certain halachic problems. But since we have control over it, the fact that there are halachic problems, that's not something that physically prevents us from rebuilding it. And therefore, we should no longer do Kriya when we see the Har HaBayit. And finally, one more point. If those of you who read the Sfarim blog, there was something very relevant to our talks on the Nazir. In the recent issue, Rabbi Eliezer Brot reviews a book of Tshuvot, of Responsa, by the great Rabbi Chaim Berlin. A few interesting things. By the way, he quotes Rabbi Chaim Berlin as also thanking Hashem every day that he wasn't an Av based in Aved, that he didn't have to be a pulpit rabbi. But he quotes a question to Rav Chaim Berlin from Menashe Grossberg. He was a Rav in England for a while. Is it usur, is it forbidden to be a vegetarian? Because the Torah has given us meat. And remember, the Nazir was a vegetarian. And Rav Chaim Berlin explains that, no. This is a neder like any other neder. There's nothing wrong with it. Incidentally, in this article by Rav Avinair, when Rav Avinair, the story is that the Tzvi Yehuda went to the Nazir and said to him that when I went to the Har HaBayit yesterday, this was the day after the Six-Day War, I didn't do Kriya. The Nazir replies to him as follows, that Rav Kook, the father, Maran, was also there at Har HaBayit yesterday, and he too didn't do Kriya. So you get a sense of the mystical, not only that, the Nazir says he was in his Shabbos clothes, and the Yerushalayim Shalmala, and the heavenly Jerusalem, was down together with the Yerushalayim Shalmata. So that is interesting, I think. Okay. By the way, with regard to Rav Kook, some of you might have seen this article. Simple called it to my attention, The Jewish Week. Very interesting article by Jerome Chainis on the demise of religious Zionism. But when he says that Rav Kook was identified with the anti-Zionist Agudas Yisrael, you can't be more wrong than that. Okay. Let's begin where we left off. I ended last class talking about the idea of settlement in the land of Israel. I even mentioned, I think by mistake I said Gainesville, I meant the Galveston plan, and that too was not 100% accurate. The Galveston plan was really not about settling Jews per se in agricultural settlements like many more. It was mostly focused on getting Jews away from the cities, like the Lower East Side and Boston and Chicago. Of course, then Jews would have been able to do whatever they wanted, but it wasn't a plan per se to set up agricultural settlements. But this is what Rav Avinair, what Rav Kalischer was interested in, and we ended last class by mentioning that there were those who thought that the land of Israel is a holy land, that you shouldn't do work in the land of Israel, and that the idea of the land of Israel is to be supported by people living outside the land of Israel. It's a completely spiritual place. This takes me back to what I said about Rav Soloveitchik. One of the things I think people like him would find shocking about contemporary Orthodoxy, really incomprehensible, is the following. All of our grandparents would have regarded it as a mark of shame if they had to take public assistance. It's true, some of them no doubt had to take public assistance for a short period of time if they couldn't help it, but it was regarded by them as a mark of shame, and it was vital to them, very important, that they have to get off this, they have to make a living with dignity. The idea that today we could have large segments of the Orthodox world, especially in Israel, who not only see no shame in taking food stamps, welfare, Section 8, being supported by tzedakah, by the government, but they actually see this as a goal, that this is something you should plan on, and, you know, it's just, that's one of the things that, you know, was just, he would find incomprehensible. And Rav Tirsch Kalischer also found it very problematic. And not only him, the Chasam Sofer, incidentally, also agreed with Rav Tirsch Kalischer. In his commentary to Sukkah, Tractate Sukkah, page 36, he famously says that the mitzvah, the commandment of living in the land of Israel, is not just living in the land of Israel, but working the land of Israel. Working the land of Israel, making it into a land, a living land, is part of the commandment. He says, just like you can't say that I'm involved, let's say, I'm not going to put tefillin on today because I'm involved in the mitzvah of Torah study, so too you can't say that living in the land of Israel that I'm involved in Torah study, therefore I'm not going to go out and gather my produce. It's bittul Torah. The Torah commands us, the Chasam Sofer says, in the Asafta Deganecha, you have to gather your produce. And this is Yishuv Ha'aretz. This approach, which is also shared by Kalischer, would later influence the Lev HaIvri, Rabbi Akiva Yosef Schlesinger, and we will deal with him in a future class. But unlike the Chasam Sofer, Rav Tirsch Kalischer saw working the land as also being of messianic significance. In other words, Geulas Haaretz, bringing the land back to life, redeeming the land, that will lead to the ultimate Geula. In Drishas Tzion, in his book we've spoken about so often, he says that the Avodas Haaretz, working the land, that is essential to the land of Israel, and those who live in the land of Israel and choose to be supported by those outside the land of Israel are making the study of Torah a spade to dig with, like it says in the Mishnah, Kardom Lach Barba. They're using the Torah for material purposes, and that's regarded, obviously, as a very bad thing. He refers, much like the Rambam did 1,000 years before, to the Tanaim and the Amoraim, who worked for a living. He had a vision. The no-work movement was completely non-existent. No one supported the no-work movement whatsoever. That's what got the Lev HaIvri put in Chayrim, and we'll see why they opposed it in just a minute. He was a voice in the wilderness. But he had a vision of the most pious people working the land, working the fields, or doing other types of labor, just like in the days of the temple. This, of course, also becomes Rav Kook's vision. The Chalukah, yes, this was the idea of the Chalukah. This went back hundreds of years, that this Meshuluchim would go out, would raise money, and send it back. But it became a value in and of itself to be supported. It became a holy thing not to work. Now, there was a time when people in the Haredi world thought that this was a value, working the land, that you had the Poei Egudas Yisrael Kibbutzim. Kalischer writes that the agricultural settlements he's speaking about establishing would have regular time set aside for Torah study, or that they would support others who would study, and there would be Yisachar Zevulun, but there would be a small group who would study, and the others would work. The idea that the entire land would be filled with people who sit and study Torah, that for him was destroying the whole purpose, because that's not a real world thing. That's not the way it's going to be in the Messianic era. That's some sort of a gullus mentality, but if you want it to be a real country, you need to create it. Yes, we spoke about Paul Egodis show last week, that it was German, but it also was Polish. There was a lot of German elements to it, but it really begins in Poland, and it's the workers in Poland. Now, Kalischer's position that you have to work the land is part of national normalization. This was a very popular theme in Europe at the time among the non-Jews, but it's not a traditional concept. But Kalischer writes that the non-Jews, the Gentiles, will see that the Jews are like all other nations, and they have the spirit to reinvigorate their national homeland. Kalischer writes, quote, "Why should the Italians and residents of other nations sacrifice themselves for the land of their fathers, while we do nothing for our land, which the inhabitants of the entire world regard as holy?" If you know your history of the 19th century, Italy was coming together, Germany was starting to get the national strivings for one Germany. He sees real problems, as I said, with people who just study and don't work. He says, first of all, it leads to great poverty. How can you have a people, how can you have a nation with such poverty? And then he says that once you have this poverty, it leads to quarreling and cheating and dishonesty that people are forced to do so they can survive. I mean, this has been the history of Jews in many places. They're so poor, they get involved in all sorts of illegal things. Unfortunately, we see it today. Much of what goes on, the illegal activities. I mean, you speak to people, they tell you they need to do this to survive. It's because they don't prepare themselves. They don't get any sort of education. And then they get, do you know that there's yeshiva bachrim now in Japan who are arrested for drug smuggling? There's yeshiva bachrim who've tried to cross the border smuggling drugs from Canada to America. You don't hear about it, but there's plenty of them. You have them in Europe, people smuggling diamonds into filling cases. You have all sorts of illegal activities going on. It's no accident that people are told, if someone, a Haredi-looking person, tells you, or a Hasidic-looking person, to carry these items to Israel or somewhere else, don't carry them. We're in an unfortunate situation now where you have all sorts of corruption. People who are listening from Los Angeles know what was going on. And for many times, it's to raise money for the yeshivas and things like that. But Kalischer wrote over 100 years ago that when you don't have money, it's going to lead to cheating. It's going to lead to machlokas. It's going to lead to dishonesty. And unfortunately, we see this. Yes, so we saw this last semester. Someone pointed this out, the Rabbi Weissmandl, the great Hungarian rabbi who survived the Holocaust as a partisan, later comes to America and establishes a settlement in Mount Kisco. Actually, he establishes an agricultural settlement in Mount Kisco, New York. His great plan was that Jews would become agricultural farmers. It never really took off. You can go to Mount Kisco today. There's a community there of Hasidim, maybe about 70 families, I think. I'm told. I've never been there. But they haven't done agriculture in a long time. He said that the Germans were more mocked on monetary things. And therefore, they did not suffer as greatly in the Holocaust. Now, look, we've spoken a number of times how we have to be very skeptical of these rabbis who think that they understand the Holocaust and all this. And I'm certain Rabbi Weissmandl wasn't saying this as that he knew. He never claimed to have Ruach HaKodesh. But in trying to understand why it was that German Jewry was able to be saved to a large extent, he was looking for their zechuyos, because if you think of it, they weren't as pious as the Jews in the East, they weren't as mocked on things like Kashrus and Shabbos, and yet they were more mocked on one area. And that was Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, that is, in dealing with the government honestly, that's dealing with other people honestly. So, you know, we can look at certain modern Orthodox communities. They're not so mocked on many commandments, perhaps, but the fact of the matter is that in other commandments, they're very mocked on. And, I mean, in certain parts of our community, unfortunately, you can be involved in all sorts of crimes, and when you get out of jail, they'll give you shlishi or shishi, and you'll still be regarded as a mainstay in the community. But in the more modern communities, there is a sense of shame when these things happen. Unfortunately, in other communities, there is no shame. So there, Rabbi Weissmandl pointed out that one of the great zechuyos of the German Orthodox, and I don't think he necessarily meant just the Orthodox, of the German Jews, is that they were very mocked, they were very careful on business dealings. Now, Kalischer assumed that the typical settlers to come to Eretz Yisrael would be religious. As the non-religious, he didn't think, why would the non-religious come to the land of Israel? It's so difficult there. They'd go to America or to Western Europe. Why would they want to brave such a difficult environment? In Kalischer's day, you don't have this idea of a non-religious Jewish nationalist. So he was convinced there would be a mostly religious aliyah. He did know, he wasn't an idiot, he knew that there would be some irreligiosity, either people who become non-religious when they're there, or some individuals who come. He just said there wouldn't be any mass aliyah of non-religious. And he writes about his vision is of a religious police force to prevent violation of Shabbos and other things. And if you violate it, you will be driven out of the land. Now, this strikes us as very strange, of course, but this is the Rambam's position. The Rambam writes in the Mishnah Torah about how there will be a religious police force when Jews are running the show. He doesn't speak about violating a Shabbos, for that was incomprehensible, unimaginable in the Rambam's day that Jews would be Mechalei Shabbos. His religious police force is to go around during the holidays to make sure boys and girls are not congregating at the river and doing things like that. So they're more of like an Iranian Sneus police. But Kalischer speaks about a religious police force. Now, it is not difficult. In fact, it's very easy to find sources in the rabbinic literature that speak about the positive nature, the great benefit of settling the land of Israel, and of fulfilling the agricultural mitzvot. But I don't know of anyone before Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer who read this all messianically, who saw this as part of a messianic process, a mission for the Jews. That is, you will bring the redemption by going to the land and working the land, and particularly the agricultural laws. By not working the land, and by not going to the land of Israel, you push off the redemption. I don't know of anyone before, I mean, even the Ramban, who speaks about the great mitzvah of settling the land of Israel, I don't know if the Ramban is speaking about how this is going to bring Mashiach. Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer sees that in our time, we now have a call. We can go settle the land of Israel. And if we don't seize the moment and do it, we're showing that we're not interested in the land of Israel. And after all, what is Mashiach? Primarily, it's the return to the land of Israel and creating a Jewish land. If we show that we're not interested in this, then we are pushing off the Messianic era. If we're happy to stay in the Golas, then what do we need the Messianic era for? How in practice would agriculture work in the land of Israel? Well, Kalischer writes that Jews throughout the land, throughout the world, would donate small sums of money, like a Keren Kayamet, and land would be bought. Eventually, the land would be self-sufficient. He is the first one to speak about this concept, which then becomes basic to the Zionist dream. In his letter to Rothschild, that we spoke about already, his earlier letter, remember, he envisions Rothschild buying the land and using it as a profit-making endeavor. But in his more mature thought, he sees it as an act of tzedakah, that those Jews who don't go to the land of Israel, their job is to buy the land. He deals with the three oaths. The problem that Hirsch and many others had was this idea of the three oaths for not going to the land of Israel. We dealt with this at length with regard to the Satmar Rebbe, so let me just summarize it again, refresh our memories. These three oaths are central to the Satmar ideology. In Tractate Ketubot 111a, it says that there are three oaths given to the Jews and the nations of the world. What does this mean, oaths? It means that God puts these oaths upon them. One is that the Jews are not to retake the land by force. The other is that they are not to rebel against the nations of the world. And then the nations are given an oath that they are not to overly oppress the Jews. But Kalischer points out, and it's pretty obvious, I think, that nothing he's advocating involves any force. They're simply moving into the land. They're not rebelling against the nations. They're not doing anything by force. The problem he confronted is that the Ashkenazi rabbis, the leaders in Jerusalem, were opposed to him. This is the same problem that Rabbi Kiva Yosef Schlesinger would face about 30 years later. Why were they opposed to him? Well, Kalischer claims that they were opposed to him because of materialistic considerations, and I think to a large extent he's right. What he means by this is that the rabbis were afraid. Remember, the rabbis were supported by the chalukah system. They were afraid that they would be rendered obsolete. What happens when you start establishing settlements in the land of Israel? Well, all of a sudden, people no longer regard these rabbis and these other people who are being supported by charity as heroes for living in this difficult land. People are not going to send them money anymore. If you have agricultural colonies and people are making their own livings, the chalukah system will collapse. So obviously the rabbis in the land of Israel were opposed to him. Among the rabbis in Europe who were opposed to him, the most famous is Hirsch. Hirsch took these three oaths very seriously, And quite apart from the technical halachic aspect of the three oaths, he had this conception that the land of Israel is really for the Messianic era, not for individuals. An individual can go to the land of Israel, but there is not to be a state. He believed that the state should only be established when the Messianic era arrives. Now, it's interesting because both Hirsch and Kalischer thought that emancipation was a very good thing. But Hirsch thought emancipation was a good thing because Jews then could be a part of Western civilization. Kalischer had no interest in Jews being a part of Western civilization. But he thought that if Jews were no longer second-class citizens, it would make it easier for them to make a living, they could communicate easier with other Jews, they could transfer money, they could do all the things necessary to establish a land in Israel, a nation in Israel, which they couldn't do as second-class citizens. We've already seen and spoken about how many Gedolim opposed emancipation. It was during this later period that I'm speaking about, the 1860s, 1870s, that Kalischer actually gets into a great halachic dispute with Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer, a dispute which I think is very relevant today. Kalischer was actually quite friendly with Hildesheimer. I mentioned last class the money Hildesheimer sent. Hildesheimer, unlike Hirsch, was a supporter of the Chavetz Zion and bringing the land to life. What's the case? Some of you might remember, we spoke about this case a bit when we dealt with Hildesheimer. It goes back to a 19th century rabbi named Bernard Illowy. Here is a picture of Bernard Illowy from Jonathan Sarna's book, American Judaism. There is Bernard Illowy. Here's a picture of his wife. You can maybe see a little head covering in the back. Jonathan Sarna says that that was the tradition of the rabbis at that time. The wives would wear this, you can see a little marker in the front with the hair in the back. Yes, New Orleans, Rabbi Hirsch. He is a student of the Chasam Sofer. He comes to America the mid-19th century. He was probably the leading Rav in the United States in the mid-19th century. The only competitor, perhaps, is Rabbi Avraham Rice of Baltimore and other places. His writings were published under a book called Mochamot Elokim, published in the early part of the 20th century by his son. Here is a copy of the reprint that appeared about 10 years ago. You can actually see this book on HebrewBooks.org, if I'm not mistaken. You find it there. Who was Illowy, and what question did he have that brought Kalischer and Hildesheimer involved? Well, he was a Rav, as Rabbi Jonathan Hirsch points out, in New Orleans. He was the Rav there during the Civil War. In fact, there was a blockade during the Civil War on New Orleans, and all sorts of questions came up. One of them was they couldn't get a Srogim, because there was a blockade, so they couldn't bring them in by ship. So he has a tshuva in his sefer, which I just showed you, about using locally grown esrogim, a sort of lemon. He says you can't use it, you can't make a bracha on it, because it's not a real esrog, but in order not to forget the mitzvah entirely, take it without a bracha. He also dealt with the Muscovy duck. The Muscovy duck, the kashrus of it, this was an American bird, and he ruled it was non-kosher. By the way, I will tell you, though, other people have disagreed with him. I did a little research on this, and in the 1980s, you could buy Muscovy duck with a hechsher from the Jerusalem Rabbanut and also from Rav Tzfania Drori, who's the Rav of Kiryat Shmona. I went to the OU's website. They claim that since there is a machlokes about the status of the Muscovy duck, they will not certify it, and that's always the OU's approach, that if there's a an argument at all, they won't certify it. So, for example, they won't certify pheasant. You can see on Rabbi Slifkin and Rabbi Zivotofsky, their websites, they speak about this banquet they had in Israel a few years ago when they had grasshoppers and pheasant and all sorts of other things. When they came to America and they wanted to do it, it was under the hashkach of the OU, they weren't permitted to do any of these things. But you can get a lot of these. Rav Schechter, incidentally, permits pheasant. The Rav of my shul is a shochet. They used to teach shlita at YU, and they use pheasant. He told me to come to my house if they wanted to shech the pheasant for me. I used to be able to get pheasants in America, but as far as I know, Well, I know you can't. There's none of the hashkachas today. There used to be about 20 different kosher birds. If there's a sefer from Italy in the 18th century, which has pictures of all of them, today we only have about four or five kosher birds. Now they do quail. The thing about these birds are you need a masorah for birds, but there is a masorah for pheasant. There's a masorah in a number of places for pheasant. Yeah, but I don't know if Rav Schachter holds everyone. What are you going to say? You say he can't eat any dairy items? By the way, Rabbi Rabinovich, in his Siach Nachum that I mentioned last week, deals with this dairy business. So getting back to New Orleans during the Civil War, I'm sure it won't surprise you if I tell you it wasn't the most religious of places. In fact, when Illinois comes to New Orleans in 1861, there wasn't one family in the entire city that put up a sukkah. By 1864, it's only 3 years, he had such an influence that we know that there were only over 50 families in New Orleans, in the Confederacy, putting up their own sukkah. So he was quite influential in what today we would call Kiruv, almost like a Chabad thing going out to New Orleans. But in those days, there also was a great deal of intermarriage, especially in a place like New Orleans. Has anyone written about Rabbi Illowy? No one has written. There was an article by David Ellenson about him, about the case I'm talking about right now, Rabbi David Ellenson, the president of Hebrew Union College, whose great love is orthodoxy and orthodox thinkers. He has an article. There is no book on him. There is a book on Abraham Rice, and Sarna discusses him and others, but there is no book, and there's plenty of stuff. Here's his volume of Tshuvot. It's not the thickest, but he was involved in polemics against the reformers. You can read about it in Isaac Leiser's newspaper, The Occident. You can get it online. So a fascinating figure. There's someone else wrote an article dealing with Illowy, but there's no extended treatment of him. So you had all these intermarried couples in New Orleans. Now, the question that came to Illowy was not the typical one that rabbis took in those days, which is a standard question. Can you convert the intermarried spouse? And I tell you that for the most part, they did convert the intermarried spouse. That was standard. My last post on the Sforim blog, I gave lots of sources that said that basically you always convert the intermarried spouse if you can. Today, it's a bit of a machlokas, both whether you should and also how strict you need to be. But that wasn't the case he dealt with. His case that he dealt with was that you had children of a Jewish man and a non-Jewish woman. The father wanted them to be circumcised. The mother did not want to convert, and she did not want the child to become Jewish. The father, either because he hoped that, presumably, this is how it's described by Kalischer later, I assume this is correct, although he wasn't ready to convert the children at present, if you circumcise them now, when they get older, you know, it's one thing, if he circumcises the kids at 8 days, then they get older, all they have to do is go to the mikvah. Maybe do a tafas dam bris. That's a machlokas, over whether if you circumcise someone, and the person is not Jewish, but you circumcise the shei mitzvah if later on they need to do a tafas dam bris. Rav Shmuel Salant and many others held you don't have to, and that's why when the Ethiopians came, the chief rabbinate ruled that they don't even have to do taking a drop of blood, because even if we assume l'chumra that they're not Jewish, they were given milah, l'shei mitzvah, therefore it's regarded as a good milah. So if you circumcise the kid at 8 days, when they're older, all they have to do, they can convert when they're older. Hopefully the father hopes that hopefully the son will convert. All he has to do is go to mikvah. That's a piece of cake. But if you don't circumcise him, what son in an era before anesthesia is going to circumcise himself at 13 or 18 or 20? So this is a way of getting them closer to Judaism. And we can understand why the father would want to circumcise them. The problem is there is no conversion. There's no tefillah. So this is going to create great problems, perhaps, because someone grows up in the Jewish community, circumcised, perhaps even thinking he's Jewish, if his father doesn't tell him, because perhaps these are not obviously the most religious people. After all, they're intermarried people. You could certainly imagine fathers who circumcise their sons assume, okay, that he's Jewish now, he's been circumcised. And these kids are growing up in the Jewish community. So can the Moel circumcise such children? Now, I don't know what the practice is today. It's maybe some of you know. My sense is that if people call up the Moel and ask them to come over and circumcise their children, the Moel circumcises them. I don't know. Does the Moel ask the mother, are you Jewish? People have told me that you call up the Moel, he comes and he circumcises the kids, no questions asked. And if you're going to tell me, does he ask, that he has to ask if the mother's Jewish, well, what about all those women out there who are converted to Reform? Conservative. I myself have been to brisses like this. These people regard themselves as Jewish, they're Reformed Jews, but the Moel is always Orthodox, or almost always. The Moel comes, he circumcises. The fact of the matter is that from our standpoint, the child is not Jewish, but I've never heard of any Moel raising questions. But Illowy thought differently. I don't know, maybe the post scheme might think they should ask questions, but it's very problematic. First of all, they're going to start losing parnassah, and they're going to ask everyone who calls you up, are you Jewish, were you converted? I don't know how that would work. Illowy, who was the Rav of New Orleans, ruled that it was forbidden for the Moelim, to circumcise these children precisely for the reason I just told you, that they would then become mixed in with the Jewish community, and it would destroy the lines of Yichus. Yeah, with the conservatives, I'm not saying that all conservative conversions are no good. Rabbi Soloveitchik, for example, held that we have to assume that every conservative conversion is a gir l'chumrah. I did hear a tape from Rav Schechter. He just gave a talk recently. It's on the YU website, in which he claims that Rav Schechter's reason for this was that he held by this, it's called the Shilte Giborim, it's a bit of an obscure commentary on the Rif, that you don't really need a Beis Din to be converted by tefillah. It's enough if you have if it's generally known, but you don't actually need them standing there. If that was the case, then the fact that the conservative Beis Din is an invalid Beis Din, it wouldn't matter, because if you did tefillah, people know you went to mikvah and you were circumcised, that would make you Jewish. Normally the reason they say it's possible is because the Beis Din is possible. That's what Rav Schechter claims. I don't think that's correct. Because I think Rav Schechter might be putting some of his own ideas here. I'm not saying the Rav didn't cite this also, but the Rav is also on record as saying that many conservative rabbis are completely Shomer Torah Jews. They just have a little bit of a different perspective on a couple issues, but they have to be regarded as Shomer Torah Mitzvos, and therefore there were certain conservative rabbis who the Rav held that their gittin were 100% valid, that other things they did were 100% valid, and therefore, if you have and one of these rabbis do a conversion, and this is how it's usually quoted in explanation of the Rav. What I heard from Rav Schechter about the Shilte Giborim was a real chiddush, because all the other people who spoke to the Rav about these sorts of issues report that the Rav's position was that the many conservative rabbis are really Shomrei Torah and Mitzvos, and they make a mistake on a few matters. They think that you don't need mechitza or things like that. But, there was a conservative rabbi who used to go to the Rav Shir. He's one of the people who wrote the tshuva against using non-kosher wine. There was, in the conservative movement, they had this responsa, but in the conservative movement, they believe that you can have conflicting responsa as long as you have three, I think it is. So there were three rabbis who voted against using non-kosher wine. Then you had the others who said it was okay, but you shouldn't use it for sacramental purposes. One of those conservative rabbis, he's a rabbi in Washington Heights, I believe, would go to the Rav Shir. So you're right, Baruch Pelta, that I'm not here to say that conservative Jew rabbis, although today it might be different types of conservative rabbis, but certainly in the 40s and 50s it was very differently. But even with Reform Jews, we have many Reform rabbis who do conversions, and the women, their children have mila. I've never heard of a Moel saying he refuses to do them. Yes, Rabbi Boaz Cohen. Rabbi Boaz Cohen's gittin were accepted by the Rav. But not just Boaz Cohen. Israel Silverman from Toronto. The Rav gave a special letter to him that he should show the Rav notes in Israel that his conversions should be accepted. And there were not conversions. His gittin should be accepted. And gittin, you can't get any more problematic than gittin. Gittin is dealing with yichus, with mamzerus. If you accept a conservative rabbi's gittin, then you're saying that he's 100% reliable. That doesn't mean you agree with everything, but you don't agree with everything the Satmar Rav does either. but he's a reliable Rav. And, okay, yeah, question?
Forgive me for interrupting. My chat thing is not working that well, so I wanted to ask, make the comment on verbally. The Rabbi Boydy was just at a talk on Torah in Motion, at which, concerning the conversion issue, at which time he said that Orthodox rabbis who had conservative congregations committed commercial fraud or fraud of some sort, and who, if they said they did Orthodox conversions, that they're questionable.
Well, Rabbi Broad could say that. I don't know if he knows the history. 90% of the graduates of Skokie, 80%, the figure they often give is 90%, throughout the middle century took shuls without machitzas. And Rabbi Regensburg, who was the big postek there, he supported this. Approximately 50% of the rabbis graduating from Reitz until the late 60s, early 70s, took shuls without machitzas. It was very difficult to find shuls without machitzas. Great rabbis, I don't know if I should mention all their names, because today they'd maybe be embarrassed, were rabbis in shuls without machitzas. It was very standard in those days. Yeshiva University, Yeshiva Rabbi Yitzchak Elkanan pushed this. Rav Soloveitchik pushed this. He thought that this was a way to keep these shuls. Now you're going to say, well, these are not conservative shuls. These are just shuls that didn't have machitzas that were Orthodox. But this gets back to what I wrote about in my little booklet on Shaul Lieberman. In the 1930s and 40s, often the only difference between a conservative shul and an Orthodox shul was whether the shul was a member of the OU or the United Synagogue. The clientele was the same. They drove to shul on Shabbos. The rabbis were often the same, graduates of Yeshiva Shrift Yochanan. The service was the same. Many of these rabbis then moved to shuls with machitzas. So I don't know what that means to say. Some of these rabbis ended up joining the RA and becoming real conservative rabbis. I don't know what this means to say commercial fraud. The fact is that you had hundreds of Orthodox shuls without machitzas, and I don't see how you distinguish them from conservative shuls, really, on the ground. Unless Rabbi Broyd is speaking about the fact that the shuls remained in the OU and were not part of the United Synagogue. But you had shuls that went back and forth. And you had graduates of the seminary who were rabbis, who were members of the RA, who were rabbis of Orthodox shuls, with machitzas and without. So, I don't know.
I grew up at that time, so I remember it exactly. My own shul where I was bar mitzvah didn't have a machitza and had an YU rav. But I think he was referring to the fact that he disagrees with that. As he said, he doesn't understand how rabbis of that time did what they did. And I would have a conversation. It troubled me much because it reflects what I think is the move to the right. And in fact, it's disrespect to the Rabbanim who came before.
By the way, it's troubling you should say that, I think. Toronto, of course, has a long history of this. In those days, there was this ethos of the family that prays together stays together. People did not want machitzas. So you had two choices. You could either abandon these shuls entirely, and therefore they would join the conservative movement, or you could put Orthodox rabbis in there, which is what happened, and many of these shuls then ended up putting in machitzas. The people who went to these shuls ended up sending their kids to day schools. The kids then were able to, you know, push a turn in the other direction. These shuls now became Orthodox shuls. There's only one shul like that left in the country, member of the OU, although you won't see it on the OU's website. It's the shul in Denver. The one in Baltimore switched a few years ago. Without these rabbis taking these shuls, we would have lost the entire heartland. All these places now, all these children. Think of all these people like you, who went to day schools, who then became what we now call cart-carrying Orthodox Jews. All of them would have been then under the influence of conservative rabbis. They would have gone to public school. We would have lost them all. And it's not just YU. Torah Vadas, Chaim Berlin, they all sent them. Emanuel Feldman in Atlanta, the shul, which is now a Haredi shul, right down the street from Broyd Shul. That was a mixed shul. Emanuel Feldman, he went to Baltimore. I mean, he went to Atlanta to a mixed seating shul. And he writes about it. You know, this is Neri Yisrael. So this idea that they were, I mean, you have to know the era. And the reason why Rabbi Regensburg and Dr. Belkin and the Rav thought that this was important was precisely because this was a chance to save these shuls. In fact, Rabbi Hanan Wasserman, Israel Miller, Rav Miller from Israel, from the Gush Kol, his father, who then becomes an important figure in YU, he was a Rav of one of these shuls, mixed seating shuls. And his shamus was someone, or his gabbai was someone from Europe who studied in Baranovich with Rabbi Hanan Wasserman. And when Rabbi Hanan Wasserman comes to America, he asked Rabbi Hanan Wasserman, later the shul then, it was just Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur that they had the mixed seating, if I'm not mistaken. And he asked Rabbi Hanan Wasserman, could he work there on those days? Rabbi Hanan says yes. Now the Rav said, very famously, if there's a choice between going to one of these shuls without machitzas or hearing shofar, don't go. But he was speaking to certain balabatim. For the Rav, Rabbanim, his view was just the opposite. He said, do go. And Rav Schechter records in a recent issue of Beis Yitzchak that the Rav used to tell people who asked him these shilas, he says, go ask other Rabbanim, go ask the European Rabbanim, because apparently these European Rabbanim had a very different view. Rav Henkin, for example, thought that you should go to hear the shofar in the non-Orthodox shul. He said you should go to the non-Orthodox shul if that's all you have. I have to check it again. We're going to have a session on Rav Henkin. I don't think he was referring to Rosh Hashanah. I think he's referring to every Shabbos, if that's all you have. And again, these were great Rabbanim who served in these shuls, and big Talmidei Chachamim, and some of the names are the leading figures in American Orthodoxy. Yeah. And Rabbi DeSola Poole, that's right, Rabbi DeSola Poole, thank you, Rabbi Hirsch, says in an essay he wrote in the 1950s or 40s that we are losing this battle against conservative, and we might have to get rid of machitzas, in a lot of these places, in order to keep orthodoxy. That was the era, what can I say? Yeah. Yeah. Okay, let's move on. Thank you, Rabbi Friedman. Now, Rabbi Illoi, returning again, ruled that the Mo'olim could not do the circumcision. Now, why did they need certain Mo'olim to do the circumcision? I'm assuming this was an era where you didn't have doctors who could do this. Today, of course, the doctors could do it. But the fathers wanted circumcision. The only people who could do it were the Mo'olim, and non-Jews didn't do circumcision. It was a Jewish thing in those days. There were three Mo'olim in New Orleans. Two of them listened to Illoi, and one did not. After all, it's his parnosah. He wants to make money. So what are you going to do? Rabbi Illoi declares this Mo'ol pasul. What does that mean, pasul? It means that none of the good traditional Jews are going to use him, but all these intermarried people, they're going to use him. It's no secret that often what the rabbis say, the functionaries don't listen to. So this creates a great deal of controversy. And if you go back to the old English Jewish newspapers from the mid-19th century, they have whole discussions about this. For example, the newspaper Jewish Messenger. There was a newspaper, a traditional newspaper in the mid-19th century. It came out in support of Illoi and said that Illoi didn't have the power, however, to stop this Mo'ol from circumcising the children. And it said, quote, if the Israelites of any city are willing to have the function of a Mo'ol exercised by a man pronounced unfit for good and sufficient reasons, it is a fact, however painful and deplorable, that there exists no authority to restrain their liberty of action. In other words, that if in America you have religious freedom, if a Mo'ol doesn't want to listen to the rabbi, he can do what he wants. But notice how the newspaper wishes that the rabbi had some sort of authorized state religious authority. He says it's painful and deplorable, the newspaper says, that the rabbi cannot enforce his rule. Today I think we know how disastrous such a situation like this would be. Can you imagine if the Rav could start determining, who could be a Mo'ol, who couldn't? You're going to start having, extremist rabbis telling us who maybe is the Rav of a city making these rules. I think now we realize that this great American experiment, and now Western experiment of separation of religion and state, has been a great blessing. Now, Illoi writes, and he explains in the American newspapers his position, that when he spoke to the women about converting, if you can get the women to convert, then we can convert the child will be raised Jewish. And the women refused. And then he thought, well, maybe you could raise the children as Jewish, although that wasn't going to work anyway. The women didn't want it. And Illoi says that even if we could convert the children,
it still isn't a good idea because they wouldn't be raised in a religious environment. The mother's not Jewish. What kind of Jew is being raised by a non-Jewish mother? This incidentally becomes a problem in Israel today. What do you do when the mother's not Jewish, the father is, and the father wants to convert the child? The Batei Din have converted the child because they figure that even though the mother isn't Jewish, the child will, they promise to send him to a Mamachti Dati school. That becomes a problem because many of the Haredim say, you can't, how can you raise a kid like that? Iloui, though, is challenged by people in his community, by people in America, so he sends a letter to the German Orthodox newspaper Israelit, which was published in Frankfurt. Well, at this time it was actually in Mainz. An open letter explaining why he refuses to permit these children to be converted, to be circumcised, and he asks the rabbis in Europe, he's not sending it to the rabbis in Eastern Europe, what do the rabbis in Eastern Europe know about intermarriage and all this? He's sending it to the rabbis in Germany who were dealing with problems like this, even though Iloui was a student of the Chasam Sofer. But he sends it to the rabbis of Western Europe, you tell me what should be done in this situation. Israel Hildesheimer publishes in a long article, you can find it later translated to Hebrew, in which he expresses his complete agreement with Iloui that you absolutely cannot circumcise these children for all the reasons we mentioned. Yet, Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer disagrees, and he writes to Iloui. You can, in here, you can see it in his Tshuvos, his volume of letters also. In the response of Hildesheimer, you see Iloui's, in Kalischer's letter, sorry, Kalischer wrote to, he wrote to Iloui also, but he wrote to Hildesheimer, and you see the debate. The first noteworthy thing about Kalischer's letter, in which he completely disagrees with Hildesheimer, and says not only can you circumcise these children, you should, even though they're goyim. First, he is Malamed Zchus. He tries to find the justification. He states that even though these men sinned in marrying the non-Jewish women, they want to do tshuva. And part of the tshuva is they want their children to have milah. He says that not only is it proper to circumcise these children, it's a mitzvah to do that. Mitzvah? How could it be a mitzvah to circumcise non-Jews? I mean, where do we have a notion of circumcising non-Jews? We actually do have a bit of a notion, if you know the Rambam. The Torah talks about the descendants of Keturah being circumcised, so the standard view is that this means only that, when Torah says the descendants of Isaac will be circumcised, the standard view is that this means that Yishmael is circumcised, but no one else on that side, and descendants of Yitzhak are circumcised through all time. But the Rambam has a very strange position. The Rambam understands this, and as far as I know, we don't have a source for the Rambam, or at least we haven't found a source. That's one of the great conundrums of Maimonidean scholarship, to find sources. The Rambam says it means a descendant of Keturah for all time, and now that the Ishmaelites have mixed in with the descendants of Keturah, right? All Ishmaelites, all Arabs, are obligated in circumcision, so Arabs have not just the 7 Noahide laws, the 8 Noahide laws. The Rambam holds that Arabs are mechuyav al pi haTorah to be circumcised. It's a very strange halacha. But Kalischer is not referring to Arabs, obviously. He says it's a mitzvah. Well, first of all, he doesn't see it as a problem. Let's start from the beginning. He doesn't see a problem if non-Jews want to be circumcised. And he says not only is it not a problem, it's a good thing, because later in life it'll be easy to convert. Why should we care if they're converted? Here, Kalischer says something very interesting, which I think could be of great relevance to the issues now in Israel with the Russian Aliyah, not just Israel, in America. Assimilation, intermarriage is rampant in America, in Canada. Kalischer says that these children are Zera Kodesh, holy seed. I don't know whether he's speaking from a nationalistic sense or a Kabbalistic sense, perhaps both, but he sees all... there's a Kabbalistic element as well, but I think nationalism plays a part. When a Jewish man has a child, you can say halachically, and that's true, it's not his child, but it is a child in the sense that it comes from him. There's a holy seed there, and if we can redeem this holy seed, if we can raise this spark and bring this back under the tents of the Shechina, the wings of the Shechina, then we are doing a very important thing. Otherwise, we are letting holy seed, part of the Jewish people be assimilated. So Kalischer is not content to, from Hildesheimer's perspective, it's a purely halachic thing. These are non-Jews. Kalischer sees it differently.
Mark?
Yeah.
Mark?
Yeah. I hear you. Speak.
Interesting enough, last Saturday evening, Rav Brookman was here in Montreal, and this is exactly the argument he's quoting regarding the situation he found himself in with the conversion of the Russian Jews and the Beit Din, etc.
Did he mention Kalischer and Zera Kodesh?
Yes.
Oh, that's quite interesting. Okay. I see we're out of time. I only have really 5 more minutes left of Ratzirsh Kalischer, but we will have to save that for next week, where I'll finish up this interesting machokes, and then we will be on to Rav Reines. So if we have any questions or comments, I see we're missing about 10 people from today, but we still have a good 20. So if anyone has any further questions or comments on what we said today, and
just that he also quoted Rav Herzog and Rav Uziel Saturday night, Mosei Shabbat, Rav Unterman, a whole group of people with this idea of the Kedusha that adheres to a child of a Jewish father.
Okay. And all of those, of course, are of the religious Zionist branch who would have this nationalistic perspective. I don't think, truthfully, you need to even argue that. You can simply say that in Israel, these kids are growing up, they're going to go to the army, they speak Hebrew, they're going to intermarry, and that makes it a Shas of Chak. That was Rav Unterman's major point. We had our classes on Rav Unterman. I don't know if you heard them. You can hear them on the, you can download the MP3s. He was very concerned with intermarriage also. But that's, so we're seeing a resurrection of Ratzirsh Kalischer's position in modern times, which is only fitting because the first religious Zionist rabbi, it's only fitting that today the religious Zionist rabbi is looked towards him. All graduates of Yeshiva University's rabbinical school were sent and led an email from the YU rabbinic alumni announcing Rabbi Rachman's passing. I'm sure it'll be in many places tomorrow. Again, as I said, it's really the end of an era. He represented, he was the rabbi first in Shari, not first, but he was rabbi in Shari Tefillah in Far Rockaway, one of the most important shuls. Following him was Rabbi Wurzberger, and just to show you how it's changed, I mean, it's pretty much become a right-wing shul today. Every year they have a Yortzeit lecture in memory of Rabbi Walter Wurzberger, who was a rabbi in Canada for a while, and what an intellect, a very close student to the Rav. The speaker last year was Rabbi Yisachar Frand. So, I mean, the idea that Rachman and Wurzberger shul would have Yisachar Frand come and speak about, you know, Wurzberger, the Harvard PhD, the great interfaith person. And then Rachman goes to New York, becomes the rabbi of the Fifth Avenue Synagogue, which is the richest shul in New York, all the millionaires. It makes him extremely influential, becomes a provost of Yeshiva University, also teaching at Columbia, very involved. And then they had the great presidential election of YU, which, as I wrote about in the Sfarim blog, to this day, no one has written about why Lamb was elected, Rachman was not. Jeffrey Gurak, because I guess he's Lamb's assistant, he wouldn't touch that with a 10-foot pole in his book on the history of YU, which is really a house history. There are still people alive, Maury Weiss, who's chairman of the board of YU, and others, who were on the board at that time. So if someone wants to write a nice article, get the inner scoop. Lamb had constituents. He was at the Jewish Center, so he had big backers like Stern, but Rachman had multimillionaires pushing him, and when Rachman is not voted in, he then goes to Israel, becomes Chancellor of Bar-Ilan, and he had support from Rosh Yeshiva. There's no question. Rachman had Rosh Yeshiva who were close to him. Rav Volk, for instance, I believe, was very close to him and others. So it's interesting to think how Orthodoxy would have changed or how YU would have changed. I mean, Lamb did a great thing. He came in. He saved YU. YU was going bankrupt. Belkin built the place, but he almost bankrupted it. On the other hand, history will not judge Lamb as kindly, I think, because although he saved the school and gave it a beautiful endowment and built it up, it was on his watch that the school really turned so right and led to now Chovevei Torah and the other things. And you could say, really, it's not Lamb's fault, and this was the change in American Orthodoxy. But the fact remains, look, the rest, what happened with the stock market's not Bush's fault either. But, you know, if you're in charge, you take the blame. And unfortunately for McCain, you know, it was under Lamb's administration that these changes happened. So in retrospect, he is going to be the one, when they look back at the changes that happened in YU, when it went from an institution, really, where in the rabbinical school, you always had a figure of Torah Mada, etc. Under his watch, after the Rav was no longer active, it really drifted more and more to the right. It's hard to believe that would have happened with Rachman, but again, these are just all speculation. The fact is, Rachman didn't get it, and Orthodoxy changed, and YU changed.
I would think that that would not be written out about at YU, but it could be a whole issue of study of what happened under Lamb and how the school developed, but I'm not sure it would come out of YU.
You're right. That's why it wasn't talked about in that book. But, and again, this might just be the forces, but the fact remains that Bar-Ilan didn't change the way YU changed. YU always had forces in it pushing to go more right, and under Belkin, under the Rav, they were kept at bay. But under Lamb maybe was so involved in fundraising, he didn't see what was happening. Whatever. Again, it's a question for the historians. Rachman obviously had a very different view, both halachically and in terms of his involvement. Rachman was always a big supporter of interdenominational involvement, as was Belkin. This was never Lamb's issue. Lamb was a scholar. He was not really an activist. He was a pulpit rabbi, but wasn't really that active. So it would have been a very different institution. And hopefully, if the series continues, we'll have some sessions on American Orthodoxy. Rabbi Rachman certainly deserves a couple of sessions, because he also was an influential writer, and he defined liberal orthodoxy for a long time. He was on the left, Rav Aaron Cutler was on the right, and Rav Soloveitchik was in the middle. So there's a lot to be said.
It's interesting that you could say the same thing with Finkelstein, who was endeavored at the seminary to make Judaism a legitimate study of academia, while the rabbis in the congregations were going, on his watch, went in a different direction.
Yeah, that's always the guy. And that today, conservative movement, does anyone even know who Finkelstein was? Lieberman, Ginsburg, they know Heschel. That's a lost era. Again, these are interesting questions to ponder. Imirtz Hashem, as Simcha says, if we continue going on, I will speak about the changes in American Orthodoxy and Rachman's vision. He had a vision. You see it as early in his book, One Man's Judaism, but he didn't put it into play L'maisa. When he saw the changes of Orthodoxy in the 70s, then he began putting in L'maisa. And really, at the end of his life, he died really an outcast and isolated from the Orthodox world, very different than the president of the Rabbinical Council of America, who led this, or one of the leaders of this trip of rabbis to Russia in the midst of the Cold War. This important academic figure, intellectual figure, it really ends very differently. As with Eliezer Berkovitz, another important figure that perhaps we can deal with. And as with Shaul Lieberman, since you mentioned that. By the time he passes away, he no longer had a community. His followers, his institution, had been taken away from him.
I am the last class to have his signature on the ordination document, because the next Pesach on Israel, he passed away.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you very much. And Rabbi Lamb himself. Okay, well, let's take time for one or two more minutes if anyone wants to make a comment or a question. Okay, yes, all in good time, God willing. Okay, well, then thank you very much. Thank you for all the comments again, and all of you who've emailed. Thank you, Kenneth. I didn't get to all the emails, because otherwise I'd spend the whole class dealing with it, but I try each class at the beginning to at least spend 10 minutes so that there's some give and take, and people know, because I'm sure many of you have the same comments or questions that other people have. So thank you very much. Thank you, Baruch. Till next week, God willing.